Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. My co-host and colleague Sam can't be here today, so I'll be flying solo as we talk a little bit about history and its role in our public debates. Politicians, activists, pundits, American citizens all use history. They all debate history. They all think about the relevance of history to our current situation. Whenever we are discussing public affairs, what happened in the past is often a subject of fierce debate, and we see the implications in terms of what needs to be done in our current era. At certain points, we understand the stakes of interpreting history in very direct ways. There are often debates when the United States is about to go to war about how this compares with the Vietnam War, for example. And other times, the debates are not as clearly connected to our current era. But when discussing public monuments, when discussing interpretations of earlier periods, people can slowly discern why this is so relevant today. And there are certain scholars in the academy who try to bridge the world between the universities and colleges and what we call the general public through magazines and their books. And they are often at the nexus of these heated debates. Today, we have with us one of the great American historians, Eric Foner, the DeWitt Clinton Professor of History at Columbia University, who specialized in the Civil War and Reconstruction, slavery, and 19th century America. He is the author of many books, more than I can name in the introduction, but The Fiery Trial, Abraham Lincoln and American Slavery, won the Pulitzer, Bancroft, and Lincoln Prizes in 2001. He's the author of Free Soil, Free Labor, Thomas Paine, America's Reconstruction, Freedom, Who Owns History, Give Me Liberty, and much more. He published Gateway to Freedom, The Hidden History of the Underground Railroad, which was a bestseller. And today we're here to discuss his most recent book, which is just out, Battles for Freedom, The Use and Abuse of American History, which has been published by Taurus and The Nation, that features some of his classic essays from The Nation, where he's been writing for some time. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Thanks for having me, Julian. Nice to be here.
Thank you. So you've been writing for The Nation in addition to your professional academic work for a while. How did you start using this as an outlet? How did you start writing for The Nation?
Well, it was sort of accidental to begin with. Back a long time ago in 1977, out of the blue, I had a call from the then publisher, James Storrow, saying, you know, the 50th anniversary of the execution of Sacco Vanzetti, the Italian immigrant anarchists who were accused of murder, convicted and executed in Massachusetts, and the 50th anniversary, that was a big cause célèbre around the world at the time. And he said, why don't you write a 50th anniversary retrospect of the Sacco and Vanzetti case? And I just thought, that's kind of, I mean, I'm more of a 19th century historian, but I was interested, so I did it. Basically, it took up the whole issue, actually, almost by the time I got finished. But then it really was later in the 80s when Victor Novasky had taken over as editor and wanted more historical perspective and said, look, I'd like you to write little essays as you see fit about how history relates to some of the current debates that are going on in our politics. So I started doing that. And as you said, I enjoy the challenge of writing for a broad audience, an audience that is obviously literate. They read a magazine. There was no internet when I started, so they had to read it in on paper. But often doesn't really have a clear sense of historical detail the way scholars do. So I find it a very interesting challenge to bring history to life for them and to make it relevant to things that are going on right now in our, you know, political world.
Has it been challenging? You write about issues that are often at the center of some of our biggest division in this country, such as race relations. Is it challenging to find ways to write about those topics in ways that will fit within the world of publishing, that will still reach a broad audience, but in the way that you hope to contribute to the debate?
Well, it is difficult. Of course, remember, you know, my mentor, my PhD supervisor was Richard Hofstadter, who was sort of the model of a historian as a public intellectual, and he always encouraged us, even as graduate students, to think about how to write for a broad audience, write with clarity, with, you know, directness, without academic jargon or gobbledygook. And, you know, I try to take that to heart. Obviously, race relations is a fraught subject in our society, and there are many different positions and prejudices out there. You know, I think you just have to remember what hat you're wearing when you do this. You do it, of course, yourself very frequently. You're writing in a way a little more polemically than in a scholarly tome. On the other hand, I don't want to distort history. I don't want to, you know, warp the history for immediate political purposes. But I do think, particularly on race, knowledge of the history of this country is essential to thinking about the present, whether it's debates over integration and segregation, the right to vote, or our history. You mentioned monuments. You know, how should the public history of race, slavery, emancipation be presented in our country? I think those are important issues of the present, and history can shed some light on them.
Can you talk, you mentioned Richard Hofstadter, and there's an essay in the book, The Education of Richard Hofstadter, which I think was from the early 90s, 92 or something.
Something like that, yeah.
Can you talk a little more, I don't know how aware people are, certainly of the younger generations, of who he was, but what kind of influence did he have on you and on historians generally?
Yeah, I'm afraid Hofstadter probably isn't read as much today as he used to be, or he should be. He was probably the leading historian of his generation of the 1950s, 60s, and he wrote books which are still very worth reading, The American Political Tradition, The Age of Reform, and others, the anti-intellectualism in American life. Lately, Hofstadter's writings, like his essay called The Paranoid Style in American History, has sort of been resurrected because it somehow speaks to, let us say, our current political situation in certain respects. But as I say, Hofstadter, I learned an enormous amount about writing from Hofstadter, the craft of writing, the whole, how you do it. Writing is a art, a craft, like anything else. History is a humanistic subject. It's not a science. It doesn't purport to be a science. It's not statistical, you know. I think Hofstadter always impressed on us that the narrative is so important to history and writing for a broad audience. So, you know, I can't say I do it as well as Hofstadter did. He was really unique, but, you know, he really drove this home to his students.
And he liked to be, I mean, from my read and what I've heard of him, he didn't mind being a little provocative. Right?
He didn't mind being provocative, but he always insisted you've got to be true to the history. A history which is not accurate is not going to be much use to the present. And unfortunately, a lot of, as we talk about fake news, there's a lot of fake history floating around, especially on the internet. And fake history is not going to help people think about the present very effectively. So, you know, he did emphasize you can't warp the history for current political purposes. On the other hand, you're not writing a historical tome. You select out of the history those elements that will speak directly to the present and that will support your point of view. When I write for The Nation, I'm writing a political article. Right. It's for a liberal magazine. It takes a political position. That's a little different than writing a 600-page book on the history of Reconstruction. It has political implications, but that book is not a political statement in that sense.
And where's the term the usable past, which I've seen you talk about? Where does that come from and how is it used?
Yeah, well, I like that term. I think Howard Zinn used it in the 1960s. It originated, I think, in debates among kind of 1960s radicals about whether being a scholar was pointless or not. Shouldn't you be out in the streets, you know, changing the society? What's the point of being in the archive for studying some arcane issue of the past? And people who wanted to sort of be both, like Zinn or Staunton Lind or others, talked about a usable past. That is the way in which understanding history can actually be of great benefit to those who want to produce social change, to figure out where things came from, to figure out how change happened in the past, how social movements succeeded or didn't succeed, In the past. And so at that point, the idea of a usable past was sort of a way for people who considered themselves sort of liberal or on the left to justify to themselves what they were doing as scholars. But I think more generally, to me, it means, you know, finding in history things that are relevant to the present, finding in history illumination of the present. And, you know, so a history that is useful in understanding the present. That's what I mean by it. Not warped, not biased, but still, you know, something that's actually can have an effect on current political debates.
And what do you think? You wrote a great essay in the book from 1979 on docudramas on television.
Yeah.
And it's about then there was a large number of these were gaining attention, and you wrote a critique about how to think about this kind of history, its limitations, even if it was getting conversations out there.
Yeah. You know, I was totally out of the blue. I was invited to a conference on docudramas, mostly of Hollywood and TV producers out in a nice resort in California. I was a young professor, and I said, yeah, this sounds pretty cool. You know, let me go out there. But, you know, I think docudramas have somehow faded. But, you know, these are a kind of a hybrid of documentaries and fiction. They reenact the present. It's not like a documentary on PBS, you know, Ken Burns or something, where they're showing you pieces of the past, but nobody thinks they're not enacting them. But in docudramas, they are reenacting, like one of the most prominent back then had to do with the Cuban Missile Crisis, and they sort of showed you they had actors in the White House debating Robert Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, you know, what do we do in the Cuban Missile Crisis? The problem with it, as I saw it, was they claim to be historically accurate, and yet they invent an enormous amount. They want the imprimatur of history without the discipline of history, that you can't just put words in someone's mouth without having direct evidence that they actually said those words. So I basically felt as a hybrid, it had the worst of both worlds. You know, it kind of got boring after a while if they're trying to make it a history lesson. But on the other hand, it didn't really use TV as effectively as it might for drama, for excitement, etc. But I must say, Julian, and I don't know what kind of experience you've had with this, I have become more and more skeptical over time, not just of docudramas, but of TV and Hollywood history altogether. Mm-hmm. I just think it's a different genre. I think there's something about it that just inevitably distorts the history. It may be that what really the problem is that it is inevitably drawn to the great man theory, whether it's, you know, a movie like Lincoln or Malcolm X or Gandhi. It's always a man, by the way. They don't make movies like that about women. And maybe that's just the nature of the medium, the film, that it just focuses on one person. And that, you know, that's not what we do as historians. Even as a biographer, you have to look at the whole context. You have to look at the world the figure is in. And most of these Hollywood things don't do that very effectively. And eventually it, you know, gives you the impression that one great figure is what determines, you know, how history moves along.
Did you like Hamilton? I don't know if you saw it.
I loved Hamilton mm-hmm. as a musical. It's exciting. It's uh-huh. dynamic. As a history lesson,
same kind of
you know,
problems.
I
yeah.
mean, actually, there's been pretty good history in it, but of course, it's distorted, and it's going to be. You can't put a person's whole life and the Revolution and the Constitution into a two-hour musical without oversimplifying and distorting. You know, my feeling about this is if people go to see Hamilton or they watch the movie Lincoln, that it'll inspire them, it succeeds if it inspires them to go out and read a book, mm-hmm. which in Hamilton it has. Ron Chernow's biography has been a bestseller ever since Hamilton hit Broadway. Then it's good. If that's all you know about that history, you don't know that much.
So another area you've written a lot about in the essays in the book, and I know you've been involved in often as a consulting, has to do with public monuments and museum mm-hmm. exhibits on issues, I'm sure, ranging from the Civil War to other aspects of race relations. Can you talk? You've offered a lot of criticism about how this is done And can you talk
more
about
that? I hope you don't get the impression all I do is criticize.
No, not at all.
On the other hand,
you're involved.
That might be true.
Yeah.
You know, they historians are generally considered to be killjoys by people.
Right.
Someone goes to a museum and has a great time and enjoys it, or goes to see a movie, and then the historian comes along and says, yeah, that's really no good. I'm sorry. It's all full of inaccuracy. And you ruin their evening, and no one wants to hear from you. But, you know, again, my life has been determined by strange accidents. Maybe that's a lesson for the study of history. You know, again, out of the blue in the 80s, I got called by the Chicago Historical Society saying, you know, we want to put together a new exhibit on Lincoln and the Civil War era, and we want you to be the chief historian on it. And I said, look, I have no museum experience. And they said, that's fine. We know how to make a museum exhibit. We just don't know what the history is, the up-to-date history right now. And we want you to determine that. So I thought it was a really interesting challenge, and I worked with them, and we had a very successful exhibit, and I've done a few others elsewhere, New York Historical, Virginia. And I, you know, I think it's very important. This is another thing Hofstadter used to say, you know, that wherever there is history, historians ought to be there. We should not just remain in the ivory tower. Hundreds of thousands, millions of people get their history through historical societies, museums, through these exhibits. And, you know, it's a totally different genre than writing a book, obviously. When you're writing a book, it's your book. You can say anything you please, and it's out there, and people like it or not. A museum exhibit is a collaborative experience with many, many people with their inputs, whether it's designers, lighting people, curators, you know, publicity people. It's not just your thing anymore, the way writing a book is. But and of course, you can't. You know, you have to learn how to convey history visually. That's the challenge, you know, mm-hmm. through images, through artifacts. When I was doing the Chicago one, you know, there was a label. I had to write a label to go on for the section on slavery. I said, well, how many words do I have? They said, no more than 150.
Uh-huh.
I had to tell the story of slavery in America in 150 words.
Mm-hmm.
That's a challenge, you know, and I think it's a good challenge. So I think we ought to be there. But, and as you well know, the presentation of history in museums has became very controversial during the so-called culture wars of the 1990s. There was a whole debate over the Smithsonian and its effort to, you know, mark the dropping of the atomic bomb, the anniversary of that, the 50th anniversary, and that eventually that's failed. They couldn't do it because veterans groups and historians and others had completely diametrically opposed views about how that decision by President Truman ought to be presented. So, I think it's important for historians to get involved in those sort of venues, even if they're subject to all sorts of pressures that just sitting there and writing a book don't subject you to.
And sometimes this plays out in other ways. You show in the book, you have an article about history, the history curriculum in Texas, about how certain parts of it have been somewhat twisted, and you have an essay on warped history in South Carolina.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about how that plays out in these arenas from education to public culture?
Well, Texas, as you know, it's a big place to begin with, and it has an outsized influence on how history is taught around the country because they have this Texas school, this commission, you know, that authorizes textbooks, American history textbooks, for use in the schools up through high school. If you don't get on their list, you're not going to be used. And Texas is a big market, and they set up their guidelines. And, you know, I always tell people, you want to know how important this is? Where was Lee Harvey Oswald when he shot Kennedy? The Texas school book repository, right?
Mm-hmm.
Depository. They got a whole skyscraper in Dallas full of textbooks. That's what that building is. And so, you know, they set up their guidelines. Usually the guidelines are kind of anodyne. You got to have a section on the Constitution. You got to deal with this or that. But since everything in Texas and the country seems to have become politicized, you know, this Texas commission began setting up guidelines, you know, pro-Confederate. They eliminated references to, you know, you can't have references to church and the separation of church and state in American history. In other words, they really wanted to politicize the history curriculum from a very right-wing perspective. And so I wrote about that. You know, now I have never my colleague, Alan Brinkley, who wrote a textbook which is used down there, actually had to go and testify before them one day and answer questions about why does your textbook, you know, talk about Thomas Jefferson here and that kind of thing. The people doing this are not historians. The leader of the Texas Commission was a dentist. Nothing wrong with dentists, but just as I wouldn't, you know, want a historian to do my teeth, I'm not sure I want a dentist to be determining what students learn all through Texas in history. South Carolina, again, I wrote that, I think, about Dylann Roof, the young guy who shot those black people in a church a couple of years ago. You know about that, of course. And just, you know, where does this guy come from? And although he's not a historian at all, he talked about history. He was interested in history. He sort of reflected, and it is, you know, in his posts on Facebook, he gave a pro-Confederate view of history, and which is deeply racist and which is widely shared in South Carolina. Not that most people there are homicidal maniacs like he is, obviously, but the whole notion of black people, blacks going around raping white women. He visited slave plantations. He had pictures of himself there. I sort of tried, well, what is the history that's in this guy's mind that he's talking about? And where does it come from? And that does relate to this question which you mentioned of monuments, you know, because, you know, there's a lot of debate. Should we take down monuments? Should we deal with them in some way, recontextualize them? But the basic fact is that throughout the South, the presentation of history in these public monuments, in public space, is entirely biased. It's all the pro-Confederate. That's fine. That's part of the Southern tradition. But African-American history, which is also part of Southern history, is completely ignored. Slavery, almost entirely ignored. Reconstruction, totally ignored. So it's a one-dimensional view of history that people get every time they look up at a monument or look up even on, you know, schools being named after people or street signs, streets named after people. You know, there are a lot of monuments to Nathan Bedford Forrest, one of the founders of the Ku Klux Klan in the South. There aren't a heck of a lot of monuments to black leaders of Reconstruction, the first African-American congressmen, senators, public officials, a major, you know, experiment in interracial democracy in America. You don't see that in the public display of history at all. So it's not just a question of taking things down. It's why is there this complete bias in the first place? So I've tried to write about that also.
And then you've written about when there are conscious efforts to suppress dissent or suppress certain interpretations of history. You have an essay in there from 2003 about the Bush administration after the war has begun. And you wrote, "Self-proclaimed patriots not only seek to determine the boundaries of acceptable speech about the present, but rewrite to create a more politically useful past."
Right.
Can you talk a little
bit
about
that? Well, that was, you know, after the 9/11 attacks and then the invasion of Iraq, not long after that, you had people like Lynn Cheney and William Bennett, both ex-heads of the National Endowment for the Humanities, both very conservative, explicitly saying, look, we're in this, you know, you had this clash of civilizations idea at that point. We're in a long struggle with, you know, sort of like the Cold War, with our ideological enemy. In this case, it's Islam in some form. And we have to mobilize. We got to mobilize for this struggle. And part of the mobilization is military, and part of the mobilization is ideological. And the ideological part is to promote a sense of patriotism and purpose, and, you know, sense of identity among the American people for this struggle. And historians have to play their part. And they said, you know, the history that's being taught now, of course they exaggerated, is it's not usable. It's not a usable past for this struggle. It emphasizes slavery. It emphasizes the maltreatment of Native Americans. It emphasizes long struggles by women to get their rights, you know, that took a long time. We don't need that. We need to focus on the great men of history. We need to focus on the great leaders, the presidents, to history should build patriotism. That's what they said. And historians have to get on board. I objected to that. What can I say? That's not the role of the historian. Our role is to try to tell the truth as effectively as we can. And a history which is purely celebratory is not going to go. People are going to find it implausible to begin with, you know. A history that's more mixed, that is both critical and celebratory, that highlights the failings and successes both of American history, will actually be more valuable to everybody, left, right, and center. But, you know, that went on for a few years, and people like me were singled out to my great pride. I was singled out in some books by these guys. I was in a book, one of the 100 most dangerous professors in America. I don't think professors generally are very dangerous, but I was on that list. I was also mentioned in a book called The 100 People Who Are Screwing Up America. There were only two professors on that list, me and Howard Zinn, so many of my friends were very jealous. I was number 75. I was right behind Latrell Sprewell, the basketball player who choked his coach. So it was a fairly eclectic list. But so these right-wing ideologues wanted to determine what kind of history was going to be taught as a way of mobilizing support for the wars that were going on. As you well know, this kind of thing happened in World War I. You know, Committee on Public Information enlisted historians to mobilize support. Most of the history they wrote was not very good, you know, and a lot of them were rather embarrassed later on about what they had written to as the history of the United States, which would lead right up to declaration of war in World War I. So, I felt the need to comment on this also.
Do you think you mentioned Howard Zinn, and many historians of your generation were influenced by the war in Vietnam, by the civil rights struggle. It energized you in some ways to not only write the straight academic books, but some of your public role in public writing came out of that era. Some people are asking if something like that will happen now with President Trump.
As you know, many historians are very alarmed by President Trump and many of the things he says and does. Part of that is political in a sort of narrow sense, that is, they don't agree with his policies. Part of that is based on history. You know, we know the history of immigration. We know the history, or we should know, of civil liberties in this country. And the what we know is the is that these things cannot be taken for granted. You know, equality before the law, the right to dissent, things like that are fragile very often, especially in times of crisis of one kind or another. And you know, so people are worried about Trump because they feel that he is sort of reflecting some of the most dangerous tendencies in American history. Not all of them. Obviously, there's many wonderful tendencies in American history, but there are also these tendencies toward nativism, toward racism, toward singling out the other, whether it's an immigrant or someone else, as the cause of the problems of the country. And you know, so yeah, I think historians should weigh in on the issues of the present. We are citizens as well as scholars, and we should take part in public debates.
What was your response when President Trump made his statement about Andrew Jackson and the Civil War? What went through your head?
Well, what went through my head was what Ronald Reagan said in one of those presidential debates. You know better than I which one it was, probably 1980, right? There he goes again.
Yes, against the only debate that year.
Yeah, right. You know, I have mixed feelings. On the one hand, when you hear Trump say, "Why hasn't anyone asked what the cause of the Civil War was?" you have to just scratch your head, because people have been asking that ever since the Civil War, right? It's not like a new question that Trump just came up with. Andrew Jackson, if he had been alive, he would have settled the Civil War. Not likely, I don't think. But, you know, I also have a feeling that we should not just respond to every tweet, every offhanded comment, everything that pops out of the mouth of President Trump, because he's so impulsive. He doesn't think and then speak. You know, he just speaks the first thing that pops into his head, and it almost dignifies what he says to respond to it. My view is that the best way to respond to Trump is to ignore him in a certain sense, since he's such a narcissist and attention is what he wants. If you don't give him attention, he'll become very upset. Now, you have to pay attention to the president of the United States, obviously, and what he does. But some of these statements, you know, so I didn't, you know, people called me and they said, what about this? And I try to explain a little bit about Andrew Jackson and his role in history. But I don't feel that I have to leap into the fray every time Trump says something about history.
Looking back on your essays as you put this book together and you read through all the work you've been doing for many decades now, writing for The Nation, what work are you most proud of? What stands out to you?
One little essay in there that I am extremely proud of, which was written right after 9/11. Right, I mean, two or three days after 9/11. And, of course, I'm in New York, you know, so it hit home to me in a way that obviously it hit home to everybody, but more specifically to people in New York City. You know, you could see the smoke rising over this city for days and days and days after that event. It was real, you know, and but I began hearing on TV, you know, the people, the right wingers, the people in the administration, this gives us the opportunity to go to war. We're going to change the whole Middle East. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. And people have to watch out what they say. Nobody can, you know. And I wrote this little essay about civil liberties. That's all. Civil liberties in wartime. I think, you know, and that if you want to be a patriot, I said, the most patriotic thing you can do right now is defend civil liberties and equality before the law for everybody. And that has been very widely reprinted, that little essay, to my astonishment. It's been reprinted in a lot of, like, English courses all around the country as an example of sort of argumentative writing, a short piece that makes a powerful argument. You know, how do you do that? And I, you know, looking back, everybody would say, but at that moment, you know, there was a lot of pressure to shut up, to rally around the flag, to, you know, say, all right, look the other way, you know. All right, they're rounding up thousands of Muslims, but, you know, we can't really do anything about that right now. Things are tough. You know, so I'm very proud that at that moment, in my own little way, I stood up for what I think is the best in the American tradition and not just the fear and hysteria which swept the country for a bit after 9/11. It abated, and it's good. And we never did go down the road of, you know, World War II and interning people and all that. But I think, you know, these things, as I say, are fragile and they need to be defended. I knew it would not be popular, and I got a lot of hate mail or hate email. But, you know, I've got tenure, you know, and what is the purpose of tenure if it doesn't enable you to say what you think, even if it's unpopular at a moment? Mm-hmm. Too many people with tenure don't speak up. And, you know, I didn't consider it courageous. If you're tenured, nobody's going to take my job away, no matter what I say. And so that one essay does stick out in my mind as one of the ones I'm very proud of in that book.
We're just almost out of time, but if I can ask one more question, you know, you've unlike many historians, you've written about many different periods and issues, a little like Richard Hofstadter. But obviously, the heart of your work has always been the 19th century, the Civil War Reconstruction period. Going back when you were in graduate school and you were deciding what kind of historian you wanted to be and what issues animated you, how did you reach the conclusion that this is what you wanted to focus your career on?
Well, I think there were two things. One is I was in college and then graduate school in the 60s in the height of the Civil Rights Revolution. You know, this was happening in the streets, tremendous crisis for the society. Obviously, I was totally sympathetic to the aspirations of black people for justice. And that led many of my generation of young historians to think about where this came from. You know, at that time, slavery was not a major issue for American historians. Race relations the history of it was rarely being studied outside of the black colleges. And then a new generation of people like myself came along and said, well, we've got to figure out where this is coming from. Where in American history is this civil rights movement coming from? Why is it necessary now, 100 years after the Civil War? And I started studying the anti-slavery movement, which seemed like a precursor to what was going on then. But I also had the first history course I ever took in college was from a very inspiring teacher, James P. Shenton, a year-long seminar on the Civil War Reconstruction era. And it shows you how an inspiring teacher can actually really affect your life, because I'm studying that ever since, you know. So it was the combination of a great teacher and just what was going on in the society that directed me to that period of history that I study.
Well, that wraps up our episode. Thanks again. Thanks again for joining us, Eric.
Again, thank you, Julian.
This is Eric Foner from Columbia University, whose new book is Battles for Freedom, The Use and Abuse of American History, available in bookstores, online, on Amazon, and everywhere else you can purchase books. It's really a fantastic read. And to everyone, thanks again for joining us on Politics and Polls. Sam will be back next week, and we'll be back soon with more conversations.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series about the 2016 presidential election produced by WooCast. The content discussed in this podcast is intended to be informational only. It does not represent nor reflect the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.